As the temperatures fall along with the precipitation, millions of Texans stranded or worse by winter weather. The Big Chill, our top story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Coming up, conversations with reporters from across Texas on how Texans are weathering conditions that have brought large parts of the state to a standstill. Also, missing out on the vaccine, but getting something else instead. Scammed, a report from Houston. A major disconnect with rural Texas concerns that a lack of broadband is leaving some Texas towns far behind. Plus, new efforts to reunite families separated by U.S. immigration policies. Those stories and more when the Texas Standard gets underway. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's cold, and that's an understatement. One of those freezes Texans will be talking about for years to come. It's Texas Standard Time on this 15th day of February 2021, where much of the state is in shutdown mode. Blanketed by layers of white stuff we are told is called snow. Not the wintry mix we sometimes see in the big cities during winters, but the drifting, powdery stuff that seldom falls south of the panhandle. On a quite serious note, this storm is putting severe pressure on the state's power grid. With many locations reporting rolling blackouts, Dallas Morning News at last check reporting that over a million Texans are without power. Those blackouts were supposed to be anywhere from between 5 and 40 minutes in length, but they've extended for hours in some parts of the Lone Star State, compounding the difficulties for some in San Angelo. Reports of industrial pollutants leaving some residents there without water. We'll be talking with a city councilwoman there a bit later in the broadcast. But first, we're going to turn to reporters at some of our partner stations to get an overview of how Texans are trying to cope with this big blast of winter. We first turn to Brett Jaspers, reporter for our partner station, KERA in North Texas. Brett, you managing to stay warm?
Yes, staying warm. Well, you know, got the chills a little bit, but we're trying to keep our heat low like the experts are encouraging.
Well, you know, the question of the day, I guess, for a lot of Texans is, how much snow are you seeing outside your window?
Well, what I'm seeing is just a couple of inches, and when I'm looking at the accumulation numbers for North Texas, you know, it's between 1 to 4 inches or so. I imagine that some little pockets have more, but I think the cold temperatures and then the kind of icy conditions are what is going to be the biggest problem up here, road conditions and people, you know, not being able to get to work because it's just so freaking cold.
Brett, since obviously you've been reporting on this on KERA, I have to ask you about the what more is known about that 100-plus car pileup in Fort Worth last week that left 6 people dead. That was a weather-related incident, obviously.
Right. It was so people woke up that morning, and I think the roads were very slick with ice, and people weren't prepared. So it was a big event here. The videos were really harrowing to watch. One particular video had this huge tractor trailer kind of all of a sudden skidding, you know, barreling into the cars in front of it. It was hard to avoid if you live up here. And so I think that accident is affecting people's approach to this weather. I talked to a couple of people yesterday who were very cautious about getting on the roads. And so, you know, we're kind of still thinking about that, but there's been some accusations about, you know, whether the roads were, you know, treated properly ahead of time, but I think the investigation or the reporting is still ongoing, and I don't know if we know a ton yet about how that accident came to pass.
What are you hearing about folks who may be of lesser means, obviously having difficulty with heat and weather like this, and those rolling blackouts that we were informed of yesterday?
I haven't heard anything about the specific official response to the rolling blackouts and people who might be particularly vulnerable in those, but I know that the official word is to everybody is to conserve energy as much as possible so we all can all kind of make it through these rolling blackouts without too much disruption or danger.
We've been talking with Brett Jaspers. He's a reporter with our partner station, KERA, in North Texas. Brett, keep us posted as you learn of developments up there.
Will do, David. Stay warm.
Now let's turn to Joey Palacios. He's a reporter at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Joey, I know you've been up a good part of the night dealing with these rolling blackouts, no?
Yeah, so I'd say probably around 2 o'clock in the morning or so, when the snow was stopping, is when the blackouts in San Antonio started. At first, they were really short. You know, I had one, the first blackout was probably about 15 minutes. And then a little while later, the power went out again. And that blackout lasted about 9 or 10 minutes. But the third blackout lasted 2.5 hours.
Good night.
And this is, you know, ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, had instructed utilities like CPS Energy and Austin Energy to start doing these rolling blackouts across the state because it had reached a point where it had to start shedding off power to protect the grid.
Too much draw on the grid, right?
Right. And so we didn't really find out until maybe around 5 o'clock in the morning or so why. And that is some of the state's power generating capacity had gone offline because of some of these sub-zero temperatures that have been happening around the state.
So it's not just the draw, it sounds like. It sounds like a decreased capacity to provide the electricity normally provided, correct?
Right, and that's where some of the struggle seems to be. Like Austin Energy had actually put out a statement saying that they anticipated their rolling blackouts to last 10 or 15 minutes at a time, maybe 45 minutes at a time. But some of those were actually lasting longer because of the amount of stress that was within the power grid. So that could have also happened here in San Antonio, where people like me, and right now I'm still without power here in San Antonio, and my power has gone off at least 6 times.
Oh boy. Is this happening citywide to your knowledge, or is this localized?
It's definitely more than just me, because people that I've talked to on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, they're having the same issues. And even some people that I know, including one of our own reporters, Bonnie Petrie, her power has gone off at the exact same time that my power has gone off. So there seems to be some type of like maybe coordination to where power is going on and off in different parts of the city.
Yeah, because she's not in your immediate area.
No, she's not.
What about preparations in advance? Of course, everyone in Texas was talking about that situation with the massive pileup in Fort Worth. What are officials there? What did officials in San Antonio do there to take care of transportation in advance of the storm?
Well, as things started to get cold and as ice started to form on the ground, we saw a lot of accidents coming up. Like the San Antonio Fire Department, within an hour, was getting a few dozen calls for service for people that had had accidents or had slid off the road. In fact, our police chief on Sunday had said more than 800 calls for service were made overnight. Now, some of those being for the same vehicle, maybe in certain circumstances, but a good, you know, that number probably reached well over 1,000 by the time the day went on. So around 3 o'clock, highways in the city were closed. TxDOT and the San Antonio Police Department had worked together to actually close some of the city's like major highways, like I-10, I-35, 281, Loop 410, Loop 1604. So pretty much any major elevated highway and overpass and ramp in the city was closed by about 3 or 4 o'clock.
We've been talking with Joey Palacios, who's a reporter at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, where they're seeing their first significant snow in like 36 years or so, at least 4 inches where Joey is. Joey, try to stay warm and definitely stay safe, please.
Will do. Thanks, David.
All right, let's turn now to Casey Ellingson. She's a reporter at Texas Tech Public Media in Lubbock. Casey, what are you seeing outside the window?
Well, since Sunday, we've received about 3 to 5 inches of snow, and it is currently 0 degrees outside, with wind chill of about negative 14. So, not really weather I want to go out in.
You talk in Fahrenheit there, 0 degrees?
Yes.
That is wild. What are you hearing about how safe people are? I presume most are in their homes, but obviously in times like these, we turn to people who are experiencing homelessness. Have officials said anything about what they've done to prepare in advance of this storm or what's being done at this point?
Well, the city and police department have been really good about communicating to the public to stay off the roads. Last week, we started seeing freezing temperatures, and I believe on Wednesday, we had something like 94 car crashes. And so I think people have done a pretty good job this time around with the icy roads of staying off. I haven't seen too many reports of car accidents. There are some reports of scattered power outages around the South Plains. Again, nothing like we've seen in the past. But so, yeah, I think people are doing their best to stay safe.
This could be with you folks for a while, I understand it. The snow has stopped falling as we speak, but you're expecting this to linger and perhaps get more precipitation as the week proceeds?
Yeah, we're supposed to get more snowfall tomorrow. And the temperatures are not supposed to spike up until, I believe, the weekend. I think over the weekend, we should be seeing like 50s and 60s. So I think we're going to see the snow and the icy roads stick around for a bit.
What now are officials telling folks to do? Because, of course, there a lot of people rely on delivery services. Those have all been canceled. As you listen to local reports, local coverage of the situation there, what are you hearing?
Well, in anticipation of the cold weather, I know people were going out and stocking up over the weekend, so hopefully they're packed and ready to stay inside and stay off the roads as much as possible. But yeah, I mean, I think people just kind of staying in shelter is what they've been doing.
Trying to ride this out.
Yes.
School canceled all around, I would imagine.
Yeah, delayed openings for schools, campuses closed, delayed openings for businesses as well. I've heard that three of our COVID testing sites in the city have been closed today. So, yeah, things are kind of on pause for us.
Yes, and I understand that some people who were who had been waiting for some time to get vaccinated, that those vaccinations have been postponed for an indeterminate period of time. We don't yet know when you're going to get any relief, I would imagine.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is some bad news out here. But hopefully it'll pick back up, hopefully tomorrow. I am not getting any word that things are going to continue being shut down tomorrow. It's kind of seeming like today is the day.
Casey Ellingson, reporter at Texas Tech Public Media in Lubbock. Casey, keep us posted on the situation out there.
Absolutely.
And stay warm. We've been seeing reports of this historic cold freezing wind turbines in parts of West Texas. That from the Austin American-Statesman. Now let's put that together with what Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, has been hearing all morning from listeners in different parts of Texas about extended periods without power. Again, the Dallas Morning News reporting a million Texans without power by their estimation. Wells is going to be joining us later in the broadcast, and of course, we'll have more on the weather situation as the news continues here on the Texas Standard. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Some Houston communities hit hardest by COVID are not getting the vaccine, including the city's 500,000 undocumented immigrants. In some cases, people are getting scammed instead. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall has more.
In the last few weeks, politicians and public health workers have been trying to get the word out. The vaccine is safe, free, and accessible to everyone. Here's Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia saying that on Houston's Telemundo station.
Es segura, es rápida, y es confiable.
And in Harris County, Judge Lena Hidalgo has launched a vaccine waitlist in Spanish and English, and a million-dollar media campaign in multiple languages to promote the vaccine's safety, including this radio ad.
Hola, Condado Harris. Soy la doctora Rivera del Departamento de Salud del Condado. Ya llegaron las vacunas contra el COVID-19.
But when I asked Maria Breceda, who is undocumented and lives in East Houston, if she's gotten information about the vaccine.
No. Nosotros no tenemos nada de información sobre la vacuna.
Breceda says the information is not reaching her family and friends.
No, no hay gente que venga a tocar puerta a decirnos, mira, la vacuna.
She says nobody has knocked on their door to say, here's a clinic where you can get the vaccine. Here are the potential side effects. Almost 70% of undocumented workers in the U.S. hold essential jobs. Yet families like Braceda's face several barriers to getting the vaccine. Misinformation, mistrust, and they're less likely to have health care. Braceda says the limited information she's heard has been on TV. Her takeaway? Only important people with money have gotten the vaccine. Braceda says her family, which has lost work during the pandemic, can't afford a vaccine. The vaccine is free, but Promotora, or community health worker Venus Janess, says people have called her organization Día de la Mujer Latina with doubts about the vaccine being free.
They're asking for insurance. Then they get nervous because they thought this was free.
Janess has helped train some 4,200 Promotores across Texas in 2020. And she's heard of scam artists calling families in Spanish, saying,
we have a doctor who's going to do this, and just give us a charge card or give us this, you know, have this money available so we can hold your spot. We can only hold it for 20 minutes. Do you want to get the vaccine or not? You know, that pressure.
She also says people call saying they're worried that getting a vaccine could hurt their chances of getting a visa. Samantha Artiga studies health inequities with the Kaiser Family Foundation. She says even though that's not true,
clarifying that information directly with immigrant families is going to be really important for helping to address these potential fears and concerns, and doing so through trusted messengers within the community.
Polling data has already shown hesitance to getting the COVID-19 vaccine, especially within Black and Brown communities in Texas. 30% of the state's Latinos say they likely won't get the vaccine. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Nothing else has quite exposed the digital divide like the pandemic. A lack of good internet access has posed profound obstacles for many Texans trying to work and school from home. Even Governor Greg Abbott has acknowledged that without better internet, some Texas towns will be left behind. Texas Tech Public Media's Sarah Self-Walbrick traveled to Jones County, just north of Abilene, where only a third of homes have access to broadband.
With the increase in people working from home, many Americans are rethinking where they live and packing up for smaller towns who are happy to welcome them.
We've got to hold up the sign, come move to Stanford. We'd love to have you. Houses are cheap. Cost of living is cheap.
That's James Decker, the mayor of Stanford. He leads a town of around 3,000. They have a Sonic and a Walmart, and most importantly to Decker, an Allseps. But that's about it.
Asterisk. Internet's terrible, but we're working on it.
While driving around town, subtly waving to everyone who passes by, Decker talks about the opportunity he sees in each empty building or lot.
The atrium, kind of this lobby out front, I think it would make a great, you know, restoration as a park or something.
He wants others to see what he sees in his small town, but there are barriers to getting new people to invest here.
You don't need a new subdivision. You've got lots and blocks that are ready to develop.
According to data from the FCC, less than 30% of households in Jones County have access to broadband internet. The group Connected Nation says, statistically, fewer people are actually subscribed to that broadband. More than 800,000 rural Texans are stuck in this digital divide. The federal government's definition of broadband means enough speed to browse social media, but not stream a high-definition movie. Decker says most homes in Stanford have internet, but it's slow and it cuts out often. And it's expensive, considering the quality and poverty level in the town.
Just the expected norm in a big city or a suburb is what we're aspiring to get to here. Because if we do that, we can bring jobs to our communities. If we're not doing that, again, we're just spinning our wheels and watching the railroad pass us by.
it's been an issue, just an issue that wasn't talked about in the way that we're talking about it right now.
Jennifer Harris is the program director for Connected Nation Texas.
The pandemic has highlighted how critical broadband is for almost everything that we do.
Over a dozen bills about broadband have been introduced so far this state legislative session, and more are expected. Harris is a part of the governor's Broadband Development Council that was created last legislative session in 2019. Ironically, the group has only met virtually. The council suggests in its first report that a coordinated effort needs to be the first step in figuring out internet needs. Harris says then they can look at infrastructure.
That sense of urgency is there. The bills that have been filed and the many more that are to be filed, they can be considered immediately. And I think we all agree there's no time to waste on this issue.
State Senator Charles Perry says that urgency is at all levels of government.
The federal government decided to make it a funding priority, so there's actual money to actually put in the infrastructure, and that's the biggest cost component. So we know it's going to happen.
Millions of dollars were earmarked for broadband solutions in the federal COVID relief bill passed at the end of last year.
The state role in that is to make sure those dollars are spent wisely.
Perry represents one of the largest rural districts in the state. It includes Stamford, but also Lubbock. Broadband access isn't a problem that can be fixed before the pandemic ends. Perry says it'll be a multi-year process. Rural Texans and Mayor Decker will be waiting. He's the kind of guy who has an analogy for everything. He compares getting the internet to smaller towns to the railroad expansion in past centuries.
The towns that were on the railroad, like Stamford, flourished. The towns that didn't get the railroad typically withered away. And that's where we are with the internet, because the internet is the modern day railroad to connect you to markets.
I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick in Lubbock.
You know, you can find out more about this story or anything else that you hear on The Standard over at our website, texasstandard.org. That's texasstandard.org. We are fast approaching 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. The Texas Roundup is just around the corner. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas officials are calling on residents to stay off the roads amid the severe winter weather. Nim Kidd heads the Texas Division of Emergency Management.
I think the highways are going to be one of the more dangerous places to be right now, not only for people driving, but for our first responders, our TxDOT employees, those out there trying to keep the roads open. Please do your part and stay off of our roads for the next few days, if at all possible, because of the severe weather conditions.
Kidd was speaking at a news conference over the weekend with Governor Greg Abbott. Abbott said the Texas Department of Public Safety had worked on over 1,000 car crashes between Thursday and Saturday. Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro says he and other House impeachment managers overwhelmingly proved their case against former President Donald Trump despite his acquittal in the Senate Saturday. The San Antonio Democrat said after the verdict, even the Republican Senate minority leader blamed Trump for inciting the attack on the U.S. Capitol last month.
President Donald John Trump was led off on a technicality. And that's essentially what you heard Mitch McConnell say, that they let him off on what they perceived at least to be a procedural issue, which was because of the constitutionality of the matter, they couldn't proceed to the substance.
57 Democratic and Republican senators voted to convict Trump. Texas GOP senators John Cornyn and Ted Cruz both voted to acquit. Later this week, Texas lawmakers will continue to get public input on redistricting. Last week, legislators heard from Houston residents. As Haya Panjwani reports, calls for a transparent process were prevalent.
Fair and open were just two words that echoed in every public testimony. Students, elected officials, and young professionals were among those who testified. Houston lawyer Emily Ebby testified on Zoom and displayed a map of her community as her virtual background, to show the effects of gerrymandering on her family.
We ask you to keep a fair and open process above all else when you draw new lines for congressional districts. And remember that they're not just numbers and shapes, red and blue. This is my family that you're drawing lines around.
The committee will spend the next 2 weeks focusing on the Austin and El Paso regions before moving to the entirety of Texas and then deciding how to draw district lines. I'm Haya Panjwani in Houston.
New COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations have dropped to their lowest levels since late November. State health officials report hospitals are treating just over 8,100 people for the virus. Fatalities, meanwhile, rose by 149 on Sunday, bringing the death toll to 40,527. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. We are now going into the second waterless week for some residents of San Angelo. The city told residents not to use municipal water last Monday after some water users complained of a funny smell. Tests revealed that the system had been infiltrated by a number of industrial chemicals, and there are concerns some of them may be carcinogenic. Most of the city has had its service fully restored, but not all of it. Many of the folks who still can't use their taps are represented by Lucy Gonzalez, who sits on the San Angelo City Council. We spoke with Councilwoman Gonzalez last night. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me, David.
It's my understanding, what, in your part of the part of San Angelo that you represent, there are like, what, 15,000 people? No way of knowing exactly how many of those folks are able to get their water, I guess, huh?
That is correct.
So what is it that's in the water? I mentioned that some of these chemicals that were found are known to be cancer-causing.
Well, that we don't know, because right now the investigation is an ongoing to find out what the source is, where it came from, how it got started. So that investigation is still going on as at this time.
Uh-huh. So is it known how these chemicals got into the water, though?
What we were told was that it was a backflow. The water that was supposed to be flowing down into our pipes, it came back and then it went back towards our water to where the chemicals were in there and then came back.
Now, in terms of those who need water, they cannot use it for showering, or they can for showering, or can they use any of it for drinking? How's that working out?
As of yesterday, we were allowed to shower and to wash clothes and all that. Everything you need, except you cannot drink it. We cannot use it for drinking. We can't use it for cooking. As far as, you know, if you were to boil it, we cannot do that. And that is why we were given water from the city. However many people were in your household, they would give you the gallons of water to use.
What are you hearing from your constituents right now? What's this been like for them?
It's been very hard. It's been very frustrating, kind of scary to some people. I'm pretty sure that a large majority of people, I'm not sure that I can say that most everybody, but a lot of us go ahead and we don't drink the water. I mean, we use bottled water, you know, but we can trust it once it's been tested. I feel we can. So I definitely trust that it will be okay once it's run through the testing and everything.
Let me ask you about something, because you said you don't drink the tap water, and I know a lot of people who feel that way. They prefer bottled water, but I'm curious. Is San Angelo's water system old? Is there an issue with sort of the water not tasting good or smelling good normally, or what?
Well, you know, I have lived here for over 35 years, and I've never drank the water just for the fact that I don't like the way it tastes. Mm-hmm. But that's just me. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people have gotten used to it. I just never have. So therefore, it's just the fact that it's the taste that it's not so much what the plant that it's old. Our water plant is old, so we are going to have to invest money in that. You know, it's also very hard. The water's really hard on your ice makers. I know I had to unplug mine because it wouldn't work anymore because the water's so hard.
A lot of mineral deposits in it, yeah.
Yeah, Exactly.
Hey, I want to ask, though, about, you know, I know that not much is known about precisely what's in the water, but there's obviously concerns about chemical backwash in it.
Yes.
Is there any sign either of some kind of foul play, you know, involved here? Or is this actually perhaps a function of the age of the water system itself?
No, there is no foul play as far as, you know, any kind of anybody coming in and doing anything. Mm-hmm. We definitely believe that it has to do with maybe something in the industrial park that where the companies might be. That's where they're investigating the source. That's where they're looking at what might have happened, what caused it, mm-hmm. the these chemicals to get into the system.
From an industrial park, you say?
Right, mm-hmm. in the industrial park area. And then what, because we've already shut off the valve for the water not to come into the Paul Ann district. So that's why we had flushed the hydrants, and then we'll be coming up with the samples to take to Austin to get tested.
I see.
And all that is being done. But as far as pinpointing what company or where it exactly came from, that we still do not know.
I see. Is there a particular kind of industry that's pretty big there in San Angelo that nothing like that?
No, not really. We've just had a lot of new companies come in, mm-hmm. but we don't know who you could actually say that
might
that
be responsible
say,
for it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. We've been talking with Lucy Gonzalez. She's a member of the San Angelo City Council. She's been telling us about industrial chemicals that have affected the water in her district. We spoke on Sunday night.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Tejas Storytelling Festival, online March 11th through the 14th, featuring over 60 storytellers, sharing the magic and mystery of storytelling and music. Tickets available at TejasStorytelling.com.
Did you ever sit straight up in bed with something circling around your head, and you swat at it as it whizzes by, and it's just one pesky little fly? You shake your head and twitch your nose and settle down to sweet repose, and when you're just about to doze, fly trouble.
My name is Wizzy Brown, and I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service, and I work with insects.
Cactus moths are native to South America, and these are moths that attack prickly pear cactus and other cacti in the genus Opuntia. They were found in Texas first in 2017 in Brazoria, Chambers, Colorado, and Matagorda County. Their peak season is going to be spring through fall. They are going to be a small to medium-sized moth. They're kind of a mottled brown color. Larvae are going to be a reddish-orange color, and they have these black dots, and depending on the age of the larvae, those dots may be really close together and make it look like they have solid stripes on them. But then as the larvae mature, the dots spread out, and then they just have these dots that are going across the body all the way down. The eggs are actually, I think, super cool. They are laid in these long chains by the moth, and so they almost look like spines coming off of the cactus pad. But the big difference here is if you see kind of wonky looking spines on your prickly pear, you might want to take a closer look, because these egg chains or the egg sticks are curved in shape. They're not straight like regular cactus spines. So if you see some weird looking spines on your cactus, definitely go take a closer look at it. The larvae are the ones that cause the damage. They live in and feed on the cactus pads, and they can destroy entire stands of cactus. You can kind of see the damage, and they will become translucent where the inside of that cactus pad has been eaten away. So if you see kind of mottled light brown patches on the prickly pear, again, take a closer look at it. You might want to break that pad open because the larvae are going to actually be inside of that pad. Why they're such an issue, I mean, one, a lot of people use prickly pear as landscaping plants here in Texas, but we're also concerned for the people that are growing this as a food crop. We're trying to get everyone throughout Texas to watch for these, but we do ask people to contact us because there are similar moths that also will be on prickly pear that look very similar to these. So you would need to get either samples of these or really good clear pictures of them. And that could be either to AgriLife Extension or it can be to the Texas Department of Agricultural Plant Quality Program.
Wizzy Brown is a program specialist with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service, and she's our go-to insect expert. We've got more on how you can report cactus moths at texasstandard.org. For years, Dallas advocates have tried to get a major grocery store to move into the South Oak Cliff neighborhood, but they haven't had any luck. Now they want to build their own by replicating a nonprofit grocery store in Waco. From KERA North Texas, contributor Sujatha Dand reports why this potential solution to food scarcity isn't so easy to pull off.
Our number one seller in produce is our bananas and Roman tomatoes.
David Daniels is the produce manager at the Jubilee Market in North Waco, just 10 minutes from Baylor University. He inspects every piece of produce before he puts it out for customers. If he finds a bruised tomato or pepper, he chops it up to sell in small, individual containers.
We don't throw away any produce because as soon as I see it not right, I'll make fruit cups or vegetable cups and put it at a price. Mine $1.25, HEB is $4.50. We can't keep enough.
Daniels knows how important it is for Jubilee to succeed. This is the first grocery store in his neighborhood in more than 50 years. The average annual income here is around $25,000, and the closest supermarket used to be 2 miles away. Now it's close enough for moms to send their kids to shop.
I'm a part of something that when they come in, they ask for me. What name is that? You know, so that makes me proud.
Dallas activist Anja Sanders remembers meeting Daniels a few years ago. She says he was quiet and reserved. The changes she sees in him and his community are remarkable.
Jubilee is really kind of the model for community-based grocery stores.
Sanders leads the Dallas nonprofit Feed Oak Cliff, which works on behalf of a neighborhood which the USDA classifies as a food desert because the closest grocery store is more than a mile away.
That's a neighborhood that has significant health disparities in terms of cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes.
That's why Sanders took her team to Waco in December, a scouting mission to get a look at Jubilee Market up close and hopefully learn enough to replicate the nonprofit grocery store.
This is Jimmy, the chief instigator of this whole thing.
Sanders greets Pastor Jimmy Durrell with a fist bump in the parking lot. He and his wife Janet have lived in this neighborhood for more than 40 years. Together, they founded Mission Waco, a nonprofit with more than a dozen programs, everything from job training to a homeless shelter. Durrell says high on the neighborhood's wish list for decades was a place to buy healthy and affordable food. The building Jubilee now calls home used to host a very different business.
This had become a convenience store by then because everybody had left. So it was very predatory, day-old bread for a dollar more than regular bread, and lottery tickets, 40-ouncers. But we came over, tried to see if they would consider selling the building. They said no way.
But Durrell wouldn't give up. About 5 years ago, Mission Waco finally had the opportunity to buy the convenience store. Durrell says the next challenge was meeting financial expectations. For the market to break even, it would have to sell $60,000 in goods a week. A neighborhood of about 400 shoppers could not sustain that. So Durrell created a public awareness campaign encouraging the greater Waco community to support the market.
By
the third year, Jubilee was routinely selling $50,000 a week. The market also stocks what its customers want, selling cactus and peppers and specialty items like oxtail and pig's feet. While the store is mostly holding its own, Mission Waco has to make up 10 to 15% of costs each month.
So we have to be even more of a penny pincher. We have to watch money a lot more closely. And still, we have a model that I think is replicable, but it's always going to be tight.
The neighborhood has changed for the better, David Daniels says, and he thinks the store is behind that. There's a new Mexican ice cream shop on the corner and a chic new coffee bar next door.
That's the difference that that grocery store has made, because I hear people saying it all the time. It has made a difference the way I live, the way my kids live.
This is exactly what Anja Sanders wants for South Oak Cliff, a store full of fresh, healthy food and the hope that comes with it. She's not sure when it'll get off the ground, but she's committed to seeing it through. I'm Sujatha Dand.
This story is part of a series on food insecurity and economic mobility in southern and west Dallas. It's reported through a partnership of the nonprofit Dallas Free Press and the Dallas Morning News, with support from the Solutions Journalism Network.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, who knows that family, friends, and caregivers play a role in the fight against cancer. With more than 200 locations across the state, they are right here to deliver comprehensive cancer care. More at TexasOncology.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. President Biden has promised an immigration overhaul that would create a pathway to citizenship for millions of unauthorized immigrants already here. But immigration advocates also want legislation to make it easier for separated immigrant families to legally reunite in the United States. Since 1997, an estimated 600,000 spouses have been separated by deportations or rejected immigration applications. Texas Public Radio's Maria Mendez has more.
She was walking on the bridge. People were beeping their horns. Beep, 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 beep.
Karina and Hipólito Mojica's 1998 wedding in El Paso sounds like the script of a movie.
No, I ran as fast as I could. And I remember all the cars saw me with my wedding dress and raining, and they were cheering.
Against all odds, traffic, rain, and even a hailstorm, the Mexican bride reached her American groom, waiting on the border city's international bridge. But their love story didn't have a perfect finale. That's because Hipólito, an ER nurse who also served in the Army Nurse Corps, and Karina have had to live apart because of the intricacies of U.S. immigration law.
Holidays are always really extremely sad. Because of our separation and because of the law, we can't be like everybody else. And it's heartbreaking.
The law is the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, signed by then-President Bill Clinton in 1996. Nancy Morowitz, a law professor at NYU, says its provisions were sweeping.
They made it easier to deport people, harder for people to come into the country, harder for people to fix their immigration status.
In Karina's case, one mistake left her banned from the U.S., In 1997, she was partying with friends in Juarez and tried to join them in El Paso.
I remember that somebody of my friend told me, you just can say that you are an American and that's it. We weren't in a car. And I remember that everybody present their IDs, and I didn't. So I was so nervous because just I have to say I am American, but I said it, but with nervousness.
The U.S. officer at the bridge noticed, so she never made it through. Karina says the officer gave her a paper barring her from the country for 5 years. When Karina and Hipólito later met, the couple figured she could apply to enter the U.S. legally once the 5 years passed. That's why they got married at the border.
I thought that it was important to have a United States marriage license. I thought that would have some weight.
When they gave it a shot, the U.S. consulate told them Karina was inadmissible for misrepresenting herself as a U.S. citizen. Morowitz says lying about U.S. citizenship had already been grounds for excluding someone from entering the U.S. or gaining legal status, and the 1996 immigration reforms made it harder to ask officials to waive those laws.
They added a new provision about any misrepresentation about citizenship. And then they created an extremely narrow waiver for that provision.
More broadly, the changes to immigration law also made it harder for people like Karina to appeal their cases. Congresswoman Veronica Escobar of El Paso wants to change that.
The immigration system in general has not had an emphasis on keeping families together. And in my view, and in the view of many others, that should be a fundamental component of our immigration system.
The Democrat has reintroduced the American Families United Act. The bill would give the federal government more discretion to review applications like Karina's on a case-by-case basis. Escobar said she has also outlined the legislation for the Biden administration, which has promised an immigration overhaul.
But this bill, to me, represents a very important and, frankly, in many ways, an easy first step.
Karina and Hipólito hope it will allow their family to live under one roof in the U.S. To stay close to each other, they currently live in Eagle Pass and Piedras Negras, which are sister cities on opposite sides of the Texas-Mexico border.
But inside of me, I feel sometimes alone, and I pray. I am a woman of faith. I pray that my situation can be fixed in this new administration.
If the legislation passes, they want to finally celebrate moments like their wedding with all of their family. I'm Maria Mendez in Laredo.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, monitoring what Texans are talking about, and I rather think I know. Something to do with the weather, Wells, right?
You would be correct, David. Uh-huh. Yes, historic winter weather across Texas. The talk on social media, officials warning of rotating blackouts, impassable roads. Our friends and listeners telling us about power outages, freezing temperatures, and sharing, of course, pictures of snow, and more snow via Twitter. Wanda Cash describes deepest snow out in her part of the Texas Hill Country, along with a temperature of 3 degrees. My goodness, hard to even fathom here in Texas. And, you know, I mentioned rotating blackouts a moment ago, David. One common complaint I'm seeing online is people saying they've been without power for hours, much longer than the 40 or so minutes the electric grid provider says they try to stagger the blackouts at to preserve overall capacity. Via Facebook, Adrian Medellin says, my area of Houston still has power, but everyone I know on Facebook does not. Via Twitter, Anne Louise Sullivan says it's been out since 1 a.m. in her part of Austin. She said her garage apartment is freezing. My toes hurt. They're under the covers. They're so cold. And Dave Beckett says in Northeast Tarrant County, there's been no power for hours and only waffling from the power company. Dave says it's not because lines are down. He calls it purely a capacity issue because of infrastructure. And, you know, just hearkening about this, back to that issue about the rotating blackouts, mm-hmm. what people have been told are these, like, you know, brief 40-minute pauses. Well, Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner earlier today, he said these are not rolling blackouts. We are dealing with system-wide power outages across the state. So a little confusion over what exactly the role is. Obviously, Texas electric grid very strained by these historic conditions. And, of course, travel is insanely dangerous for many people, definitely out of the question for many Texans. And that's certainly true for one listener, Carla Herring Boisvenue. She says there's no way off of Padre Island as JFK and Park Road 22 are closed. Ice on the road. She describes walking to the bulkhead and the dock as being very treacherous and covered with ice. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, obviously, David, a situation many Texans are not prepared for. We just don't see weather like this here in Texas very often, David.
No, indeed. And I think there's going to be a whole lot more questions asked about the situation with the power grid as people are experiencing rolling blackouts that are more than just rolling blackouts at this juncture. A lot of people wondering whether it's demand or whether this has to do with, as you were just saying there, and as Joey Palacios was telling us from San Antonio a little bit earlier, whether this has to do with infrastructure. You can keep up with all the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org. Our producers include Joy Diaz, Kristen Cabrera, and Jill Amott. And on behalf of the entire Texas Standard crew, I'm David Brown, wishing you a warm and safe rest of your Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge,
Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.